Humor can be a serious subject. At least our special guest this week thinks so, having written A History of Humor in Modern America. Fred Nielsen, professor of history at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, explores that history with Daniel Wickberg.
21st century Americans are awash in humor. Situation comedies, comic monologues, and laugh tracks are television staples. Laughter, we're told, is the best medicine. Face-to-face and online, the jokes fly. To be able to laugh at oneself is a trait most Americans value. It proves we don't take ourselves too seriously. Some jokes may be as old as the hills, but that doesn't mean that Americans have always understood humor as they do today. Humor and our reaction to it have a history. Here to discuss it is Daniel Wickberg, a professor of history at the University of Texas at Dallas and the author of The Senses of Humor, Self and Laughter in Modern America. Professor Wickberg, welcome.
Thanks.
What does it mean, first of all, to say that someone has a sense of humor?
Well, I think it means a number of things, depending upon who you ask. But it seems to me that in my research, anyway, it became clear to me that it was not simply just a matter of thinking that someone was funny, although that plays a big part in defining what we think a sense of humor is. But simply the idea that someone has the ability to crack jokes or make us laugh is not necessarily what people mean when they describe someone as having a sense of humor. Generally, they mean by it that someone has an ability or a capacity to see the humorous side of existence, to lighten situations, to have a kind of ability to see things in proportion, to step outside of the frame of their own selves in some ways, to not take themselves and their own views seriously. In other words, to be flexible, adjustable, sociable, gregarious, to have a whole set of attributes that are socially valued in today's society.
Now, you write that the sense of humor as a descriptive term and as a socially accepted value doesn't emerge until the 19th century. Does that mean that people weren't very funny until the 1800s?
I hope not. My working assumption has been that people have laughed throughout history, that there has always been an attention to certain kinds of people as being comic or humorous, that there have been various terms that have been used to describe that, whether you talk about people being ridiculous or ludicrous or comic, but that having a sense of humor is a different kind of thing that doesn't simply mean being funny. Although that's part of it, that's certainly part of it, but that people have always had comic ideas. Sometimes, though, in the early modern period, for instance, those ideas about what it was to be comic had to do with specific types of people. For instance, jesters or people who were designated as comic persons, as opposed to the idea of it being funny, somebody being funny that you meet in everyday social life.
So humor exists before the 19th century, and yet one of the main points of your book is that the sense of humor as a valued individual characteristic doesn't emerge until relatively recently. What is it that changes in America in the 19th century to make a sense of humor a valued, desirable characteristic?
Well, it's a complicated story, but I would say that one of the main changes in the course of the 19th century is the movement from a largely agrarian market economy to a society that's organized by the late 19th century more and more around large-scale bureaucratic and corporate forms, particularly in urban centers. And what that meant was that there was a kind of revolution in social values and ideas of what were considered valued attributes. And the sense of humor became one of those. And particularly, you see this by the 1870s, that people are beginning to say things like a necessary or valued attribute in a social environment is the ability to be flexible and not take oneself too seriously, the ability to kind of get along with others and to relieve stress and conflict, all of which are elements that appear in large-scale bureaucratic institutions. And as society is organized more and more in that way, there's a greater and greater emphasis on the ability of people to put their own claims, if you want, aside, put, and refuse to be dogmatic or rigid in one way or another, and to be flexible, to see things with a sense of proportion. And a sense of humor becomes part of that, the idea that people should have a sense of humor, that it means we enjoy being around them, that we work in close contact with them, is a relatively new idea. It's less than 150 years old, so... And it's really related to this changing organization of society. And I don't want to sort of reduce it to that. That's not the sole thing that's going on, because there's a lot of older ideas that are sort of playing out in the broader American culture at the time. But that change, I think, is essential to understanding the development and rise of the idea of the sense of humor as a valued personality attribute.
There are lots of different ways of being funny. One can tell a long, humorous story, for example. One way that a lot of people after the Civil War try to be funny is by telling jokes. And you make the point, an interesting one for me, that the joke is a relatively modern, popular form, one that doesn't really emerge until the 1870s or so. We have professional joke writers all of a sudden. The supply of jokes doesn't equal the demand, you write. What is changing here to make jokes so popular, and what's the venue for all of this joke telling?
Well... there is a kind of commercialization of the process of humor, and the idea that one can begin to sort of have a career in writing humor for new forms of mass circulation and commercial forums. And I'm thinking particularly the development of mass circulation newspaper and magazines that are appealing to a middle class and begin to include columns of jokes. And this is sort of the kind that one might find today in Reader's Digest. The idea there being a separate column of these specific jokes, so that you have the rise of a very small class of people who are writing jokes and selling them, retailing them, or wholesaling them, I guess, to these venues. At the same time, in the 1870s is the period when you see the rationalization or formalization of variety or vaudeville into the big time and small time circuits. And so you've got the beginnings of modern show business there. And by the time you get into the early part of the 20th century, there's more and more of a focus in those forums on topical humor, which means that you can't just repeat the same jokes that you've been repeating from town to town for 30 years, and you need to start beginning to write new material. And so there's this focus on creating material, and that's sort of the root of show business. At the same time, in just more in the realm of social life and not entertainment so much, you have the beginnings of the production of books of jokes for Toastmasters and for people who are speaking at after-dinner event, after-dinner speeches, and the American form of the after-dinner speech becomes quite closely tied to humor, so it becomes almost a string of jokes, or there's a good deal of complaint in the late 19th century that after-dinner speeches seem to have become nothing but a string of jokes, which are ones that people can now purchase. And so the whole sort of commercialization of humor, which goes on in the late 19th century, is really responsible for the rise of the joke form, which is much, the form itself is based on this idea of reducing everything to a kind of context-free unit that you can use in various different kinds of situations. So you're not, no longer have to tell a lengthy story. You have this little two-line, straight line and a punchline, and that's your joke. You see it definitely in the rise of the monologue form in vaudeville by the 1890s.
In fact, that's the root of the modern monologue, isn't it? The staple for comedians in late-night talk shows?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, the monologue probably goes back in some respects to the stump speech of the blackface minstrel shows of the 1840s and 50s, but it really takes off in variety and vaudeville when you get this specific performer who's no longer playing a role so much as sort of presenting a series of jokes. And he's not up there telling a story that has a kind of narrative line. The jokes themselves have no narrative relationship to each other. There's no story being told. It's just one joke after another. And the structure of the monologue is based on this idea of trying to get laughs. So you want your laughs to come in threes, and you sort of build up these laughs. But the content of the jokes texts themselves, is not, they're not related to one another. And so the monologue is a very interesting new kind of form, and we see it, you know, in late night television, for instance. We say, oh, you know, we kind of take that for granted, I think, but it really developed out of vaudeville in the late 19th century, and especially when you get this beginning of this turn to topical humor and towards the idea of jokes addressing the issues of the day.
Humor achieves, as we've discussed, a certain personal and social importance in the 19th century into the 20th, and yet, interestingly, it remains off limits in many professions. You note in your book, for example, that politicians, advertisers, and educators were advised well into the 20th century not to be funny. Why not? And what eventually changed for these professions?
Well, I think there is a very, very long tradition of suspicion of laughter and humor. In fact, that one might say that that's sort of been the dominant tradition in Western, in European thought, to be suspicious of laughter as kind of undermining or potentially undermining things that should not be question. And so the rise of kind of this idea that one might criticize or laugh at something is a relatively modern idea that you see beginning in the 18th century as a valued thing to do, to question forms of social authority, for instance. In the 19th century, one sees it with politicians, in particular, the notion that having a sense of humor really kind of disqualifies a politician for public life, because it threatens the notion that politics is an avenue of moral seriousness. There's all kinds of political humor that is laughing at politicians, but the politician as a statesman is supposed to be in some ways above that, is supposed to have a kind of dignity and a kind of seriousness in terms of achieving some kind of end. And that the widespread notion was that Americans would not elect people that they thought had a sense of humor. Well, by the time we get into the 1930s, certainly by the latest, that idea is completely changed. And having a sense of humor now begins to appear as a necessary feature of a politician. You wouldn't want to elect a politician who didn't have a sense of humor. Why? Because not having a sense of humor would mean that person was inflexible, dogmatic, rigid, what in the Cold War context later would be called ideological, as opposed to a kind of moderate person capable of compromise and working with others. As the avenue of politics becomes much more complex in the 20th century and the kind of seriousness of political oratory that characterized 19th century is eclipsed by the sort of media management of politics, the idea that a politician who has a sense of humor, who doesn't take him or herself too seriously, that's something that can be a very valuable thing and, in fact, a necessity for a politician. Even in the campaigns of the 1950s, this is sort of a noted campaign, the Eisenhower camp in the presidential campaign of 1952 accused Adlai Stevenson of having a sense of humor, and that as sort of a being not fitting him for the political post. But certainly by the time you get into the late 50s, Eisenhower himself is celebrating the sense of humor. So that tells you something about the idea of the sense of humor as being a kind of political necessity. And you find similar things going on in education. With progressive education, there's a kind of rejection of the notion of learning as a kind of based on a fixed body of information, and the notion of the growth of the whole personality, and part of that is teaching children to have a sense of humor about things and to use laughter in the classroom. And in advertising, certainly the revolution has been, from the early 20th century, the idea that if you made people laugh, it would belittle the product. That was sort of the message of some of the earlier advertisers. Don't have comic advertising. Now you just turn on the television, virtually every advertisement is based on a kind of comedic approach, the notion being that comedy will not, or humor, or laughter will not in any way damage the image of what is trying to be, of the product that is being sold, but that it will in some ways grab people's attention and put them in a comfortable relationship to that product.
As we close, we have only about a minute or so left. What you've said raises, I think, one of the most interesting points for me about your book, and that is that humor at some point in the 20th century becomes seen not just as a matter of being funny, but something essentially American, even patriotic, something that distinguishes America from totalitarian governments. Roosevelt, for example, says that there's a connection between a sense of humor and American democracy. Dictators aren't funny. Eisenhower, whom you've quoted already, says that a sense of humor goes hand in hand with independence of thought. How should we understand these claims that humor is somehow one of the things that distinguishes democracy from totalitarianism?
Well, we should understand them as part of a historical development and a very sort of interesting one that occurred in the context of the 1930s and then sort of on into the Cold War, that as the U.S. faced decidedly non-democratic opponents abroad, there was a kind of attempt to marshal various elements of American identity, if you want, to distinguish them from those of the enemies that were faced. And so in the climate of the 1930s, looking at the Soviet Union and the rise of fascism in Europe, the claim was consistently made over and over again that the problem, that one of the things that distinguished Americans from these other groups was that they had a sense of humor, and that a sense of humor could become a preventative against dictatorship or against totalitarianism, because totalitarians are basically people who take themselves too seriously, that they have a kind of rigidity, and that they can't laugh, and that laughter then appears as a kind of preservative of freedom. And the idea of humor as being related to freedom goes way back into English history, and the idea of English humor in the 17th and 18th centuries. But this is kind of updated in a new kind of ideological climate where, particularly in the Cold War world, where American values were to stand as the opposite of those associated with communism, and the idea became consistently applied that communists were incapable of having a sense of humor, so that the differences were not simply matters of political philosophy, if you want, but that they went down to the very attributes of personality that people valued, that Nazis or communists, for instance, weren't simply ideologically mistaken and guided by something wrong, but that they were, in fact, not very pleasant people. They didn't have a sense of humor. And so the celebration of the sense of humor doesn't take place in just a, it's not just a matter of personality attribution, but just in this larger global ideological world of conflict between the West and Soviet communism.
Funny business becomes, in the end, serious business. Thanks, Professor Wickberg, for visiting with us.
Well, thank you.
I've been speaking with Daniel Wickberg, the author of The Senses of Humor, Self and Laughter in Modern America.
What do you want, Costello?
No matter. I understand that you're going to be the manager of the Lou Costello Jr. Youth Foundation baseball team.
Yes, we just organized the thing.
Oh, you did?
Sure.
Well, I'd like to play on the team myself. You know, I know something about baseball.
Well, that would be accomplished.
Well, I'd like to know some of the guys' names on the team, so when I meet them on the street or in the ballpark, I'll be able to say hello to them.
Why, surely I'll introduce you to the boys. But you know, strange as it may seem, they give these ballplayers nowadays very peculiar names.
You mean funny names?
Nicknames, pet names, like Dizzy Dean.
Spell it Daffy?
Daffy Dean. And
I'm their French cousin.
French cousin?
Gouffet.
Gouffet. Well, now, let's see. We have on the bags, we have who's on first, what's on second, I don't know who's on third.
That's what I want to find out.
What silly name? I say who's on first, what's on second, I don't know who's on third.
Wind up your radio. I'm Dr. Demento with mad music and crazy.